Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. First question about London's Grenfell Tower going up in fire, smoke, and death a year ago was how could it have happened? An apartment block for 350 people with no sprinkler system, just one exit at ground level, 23 floors served by one staircase, and just two words of advice, stay put, spoken by police and firemen to people who were baking in their sealed flats.
Tonight at 10, we're in West London after this residential tower block was destroyed by fire.
So we have fire where?
Flat 16 Greenfield Tower.
Right, hang on.
Flat 16 Greenfield Tower.
Right, okay.
Quick.
Then come the moral questions. Grenfell's poorest lived just across the way from the richest oligarchs in the capital of capitalism, in the single royal borough of Kensington and Chelsea, just north from Harrods. Can post-Thatcher Britain, openly disdainful of social housing like Grenfell Tower, can it be charged with social murder in a horrible accident like the Grenfell Inferno? And who, by the way, is up to telling the London story of our lifetimes, the way Charles Dickens distilled the Victorian version in the 1850s and 60s. Andrew O'Hagan has the Dickens duty this radio hour. O'Hagan is Glasgow-born and Scots-accented, as you'll hear. He's a novelist, an essayist, and stalwart all-purpose mainstay of the London Review of Books. The LRB editors have given Andrew O'Hagan a full issue of the magazine to bring his story to a point, to many points, in fact. And he's giving us his experience of it all, a horrific modern sequel to the ancient Great Fire of London that remade the city in the 17th century.
That's the great question about the fire of 2017 in London. And indeed, it was the fire of an earlier era, the Great Fire of London, that sparked a conversation about what modern life was all about. This is the second time in the history of this great city where a fire has exposed a new conversation about what kind of country we are, what kind of world we live in, and what sort of protections we might offer to people who are in situations of economic disadvantage and so on. People all over Britain and all over the world, indeed, have responded to the Grenfell Tower fire as an invitation, if you like, to discuss who we are and how we came to be this way. So it's not just a fire, a tragic event, of course, in which 72 people lost their lives. It is that and will remain that, not only for the families and the survivors, but for everyone, I think, living in London and beyond. But more than that, it's become a symbolic disaster of our times, and that's what I try to investigate.
Yeah, fascinating to have that baseline in the 17th century. A tourist can't go to St. Paul's Cathedral without learning briefly about the Great Fire of, 1666. And it was much worse in so many ways in terms of acreage. We don't know about lives lost, but what is the starting comparison?
I think it's the London skyline in both cases was scarred and deeply affected by the fire. All of us who live in London know very well the Westway, that area where the dual carriageway leaves central London and goes out west towards Oxfordshire. And the tower blocks and the buildings along that route are very familiar to us. And after the fire, we had this black billowing smoke coming from a building that had been completely devastated by the fire. This wasn't in any senses an ordinary fire. I'm not just talking about its symbolic value, but the fire itself was a devastating thing. People trapped above the 10th floor,
yes,
especially on those upper floors, without any real possibility of escape, according to their understanding. Of course, there was phone calls going from the tower out to emergency services over a period of a few hours. And we now know that had there not been a stay put policy, that's to say a policy that encouraged people in the event of a fire to stay inside their own apartment, and let the fire be put out in the apartment where it was occurring. That is the standard policy in tall buildings in places like London. And I'm afraid that in this case, because the fire was spreading over the outside of the building and entering into apartments from the outside skin, the cladding of the building, that was the great cause of the tragedy here, because people who had remained were then trapped inside those floors and inside those apartments. They had heeded the advice that was given, but the advice in this case was tragically wrong.
We'll get back to the stay put policy, but just a couple of other big picture things. Your report on Grenfell Tower reveals London, the city of immigrants, as we really never saw it before, even in Zadie Smith novels, for example, but a city of Egyptians, of Moroccans, of people from all over the world.
Yes.
The other thing is, we all live in tower cities now, in a certain way, or not all, but a lot of us in the States, in China, in Shanghai, live in tower cities. When you ride past them on a train in China, you wonder, what in the world are those things doing, not only on the landscape, but to the people inside?
Well, I grew up in the era of tower block building. My family grew up in Glasgow in Scotland, and there was a great experiment almost in social housing during my childhood when we were cleared out of the old tenement slums of places like Glasgow and Edinburgh, and that happened too in Sheffield and Manchester and in London, cleared out of those old tenements into these shining new tower blocks, which were meant to bring us closer to God, closer to cleanliness. We had inside bathrooms for the first time, many of us, and it was a great social experiment to improve the quality of life. But within a generation, that's within 25 years, a lot of those tower blocks had proved insufficient. They were drafty, that they were damp. The social cohesion of which so many communities depended in the old tenements and in the old terraced housing estates fell apart for many in the tower block situation. It has to be said, though, that some of them worked very well. In Grenfell Tower, which was built in the early 70s, had become something of a model tower to some people. Many of the people I spoke to loved their flats. They loved living there. It was characterised in the media as some sort of a place for poor immigrants who were in a state of disadvantage. But certainly life wasn't perfect there, but many of them loved their flats and they loved the way of life there.
Yeah. Nicknamed the Moroccan Flats, 300 people roughly. Amazing in your reconstruction how well they knew each other and cared.
That's right. I mean, we must beware of media cliches when it comes to describing people's lives. Poor people as well as well-off people were given to understanding people perhaps too quickly in advance of knowing them by virtue of appealing to these sometimes bogus classifications. Those people in the tower block were not wealthy by and large, and they were immigrants by and large. That to say, a lot of them came to the UK within the last 30 years. But there was a great sense of cohesion. They were called the Moroccan Flats at one point. A great number of people from Morocco and from Saudi Arabia and from Egypt and from many other places came to live there, and they looked after each other to some extent. It was a close community. There was a lot of childcare and a lot of cooking going back and forth between those apartments. So let's beware of those cliches about people living in slums and so on, because I would resist that after interviewing so many of the people in that building and in the estate generally.
It all began in the kitchen, right, of a cab driver from Ethiopia.
Yes.
It's striking, looking back at the whole thing, that alarms weren't sounded and people didn't get out pronto. What happened?
Well, unfortunately, when the fire started in the kitchen on the fourth floor, the emergency services came relatively quickly and put out that fire in the kitchen, but they didn't notice until they were leaving that, in fact, fire had escaped out of that kitchen window and set alight the cladding, the exterior insulating skin on the building, and that the fire had rapidly spread upwards from there. That was the single most devastating factor in all of this, is that there was flammable cladding on the outside of the building. There would later be much controversy, and still is, in the investigation about how that cladding came to be there in such a tall building. And indeed, many accusations were immediately made about the people who'd chosen that cladding and passed it. But what we do know for certain at this stage is that the cladding was flammable and that the transfer of flame from one floor to another happened rapidly. In 15 minutes, it had gone up a multiple of levels on the outside of the building. It was re-entering the building at each level. So it was a devastating fire spread and quite avoidable if one looks at the question of that particular flammable cladding. There are questions, of course, about whether such cladding should ever be there.
Andrew, why was it there? I mean, in retrospect, it looks like tinsel on a tree, just asking for trouble, but also cosmetic, useless.
Well, that is one of the biggest controversies here. Why was the cladding chosen? And there had been guidelines about the use of such flammable materials above a certain height, above six floors. It was actually frowned upon and largely discouraged. But for some reason that we don't yet understand, the tenant management organisation, which was responsible for the refurbishment and the maintenance of Grenfell Tower, chose a form of cladding which in some quarters was claimed to be chosen because it was cheaper. Now, this is a crucial piece of evidence in the great attempt to understand how this could have happened. In some quarters, that was blamed on the local council, which is a political formation in this country, a local government organisation. In my investigations, it became clear that the tenant management organisation, which is a body at arm's length from the council that has its own decision-making authority and power, that it, in fact, chose how to refurbish the building and passed some of these preferences and so on past the housing department. So the answer to your question is it was chosen for reasons that we don't quite understand. And for me, the bigger question of all is why was it even on offer? Why was this stuff even available? How can you have cladding available to that extent, flammable? It's going to go up 24 floors. Clearly, it's a fire hazard from the beginning. And the fact that it caught fire and spread so quickly is baffling. So those questions will have to be answered in full in the end. But obviously the people who put it there felt it was sufficiently safe, and it proved not to be.
Coming up in Andrew O'Hagan's reconstruction of London's Grenfell Tower, the news you'll remember is the vitality, not the poverty, of the immigrant village inside. This is Open Source. Living inside Grenfell Tower when it caught fire a year ago, there were asylum seekers, adventurers, migrants of all ages from all over the world, 300-plus individuals who didn't look like your old idea of the Londoner. Neither did their families fit clichés about helpless third-worlders. Andrew, there are so many stories here, including scandal, maybe, tragedy for sure, question of materials, as you're saying, the whole history of social housing in England and elsewhere, matters of design. I wonder, it's so complex and mythic a story. What was your own mindset going into this extraordinary piece of journalism?
Growing up, I always admired long-form pieces of journalism. I loved writers who went into a situation not entirely 100% sure what they were going to find, whether it's Tim O'Brien's work about Vietnam or Joan Didion's work about California or her famous piece in 1991 about the five men accused of rape in Central Park. You go into these stories angry, upset, like everyone else, desperate for an explanation as to how this could have happened, who's responsible. And over the period you're working on it, you try to, in a sense, be your reader's eyes and ears, trying to bring them closer into what you actually find, as opposed to what you wish was there or what your anger tells you must be there. It's a job of a reporter to go in and actively look for the truth rather than embody the truth in advance or predetermine what the truth is going to be. And for me, that's what this story in the end was about. For all my anger and upset, I thought I was going in there to write a Jeremiad against the obviously guilty parties. But once I was inside the story, I found that there were complexities, mainly to do with how the media and public at large was responding to this case, that the fire had brought out a certainty in people rather than a series of doubts. There weren't so much questions as answers at the forefront of the audience's mind. And I felt that my responsibility as a truth seeker and as a journalist was to question all of that, to give the intelligent reader the opportunity to really sift all of it in their mind afresh and come to some real reckoning with the facts.
So fascinating. I mean, other heads that you were sort of channeling, a little bit of Zola, a little bit of Norman Mailer.
Yes. I went to see Norman Mailer in Provincetown once to interview him for the Paris Review, and I sat with 3 days with Norman, and at one point we spoke about his famous study, his book, The Executioner's Song.
Yes.
Many of your listeners will recognise it, a study of crime and punishment in modern America about the case of Gary Gilmer, who shot 2 people in Utah and then insisted that the state carry out the death penalty. That was massively influential on me when I was young because it was a book that was full of two-mindedness. It was open to both sides of the argument always. And I have to say, when I asked him, when I was with him, what it was about that story, it chimes still for me in my attempt to write about Grenfell Tower, which was that some stories contain within them the story of your times. And you just have to really listen and really watch and really record and not be swayed by possible objections to your open-mindedness or your willingness to hear the other side. You must hear the other side. That's part of what Zola would have done. You mentioned him, and certainly Mailer did. And for me, the influences were all over me in trying to write a story like this because I knew I was going to be up against it and there would be resistance and pushback. You always get that in a story where there are passions running high and you have to nevertheless go ahead and tell the story that you found rather than the story you imagined.
Like Norman Mailer, you're always interviewing yourself through this piece.
Yeah.
Can this be true? Is that a fair argument? Etc. But run through your prime suspects in this awful event.
Well, from very early on, I began to question this business of the companies who provided the cladding, the insulation, who did the work. That's to say the contractors, the suppliers. The idea that this flammable stuff was even available, as I mentioned before, was shocking. That's where the smoking gun was in all of this. That we could fixate on individuals whose politics we disliked, whose fancy names and pasts we disputed. We could fixate on political cultures that we objected to, and all of that is understandable, and certainly some objection to that holds water. But the real cause for concern in this, for me, was always how we have moved away from regulation when it comes to building materials. We've made it easier and easier for international capitalist companies to sell their wares in the marketplace unchecked, unsupervised, not properly regulated. And that is what this story is about. You know, if you're going to go after the guys, go after the big guys, go after the real perpetrators here. You know, there's a movement here, very strong movement, Justice for Grenfell. Let me tell you, I believe in justice for Grenfell as much, if not more than anybody, but I want it to be real justice for those 72 people who died, not just some tokenistic posh Tories, you know.
What would real justice mean?
Real justice would be getting to the point where this kind of cladding, this sort of flammable material, would by law internationally never be allowed to go near a building above 2 or 3 floors ever again. That's to say, people who had difficult means of escape in event of a fire would never be up against a raging fire on the outside of their building that made it almost impossible to get away from the black smoke and the flame. So that's the result for me, that you look at the whole culture of manufacture and selling and regulating this stuff. You don't just content yourself with pointing to a few pantomime villains. That's where all the energy for me comes in this. You know, that central government, successive British governments have allowed a deregulation of safety in these situations. And that, for me, is where the real cause of the deaths lies.
Speak of council housing, which has different names and is a different reality in the United States and elsewhere in the world. But I read that a third of British housing before the 70s was council housing. Then came Thatcher, everything changed.
Well, the problem was, and I grew up in a housing development, as we call it here, a project, as you would say in the States, a housing project. And the idea there was that there was a kind of uniformity. We were all in the same boat, if you like. We were all in it together. We lived on the same houses with the same amenities, with the same rents, with the same support system in terms of people who maintained those houses and the gardens and so on. Then Margaret Thatcher introduced a policy called right to buy. That was a process by which the state housing stock, the housing stock owned by the local authority on behalf of the people, was sold off house by house to people who wanted to be owner-occupiers.
This morning, Margaret Thatcher outlined the most forward-looking and progressive plans for housing that any party has come up with since the war.
People want a home they can call their own. If you've been a council tenant for at least 3 years, you'll have the right by law to buy your house, and that's that.
And that effectively killed off the old ethos of social housing as it existed in my childhood, where ordinary working class people got to live in these houses for reasonable rents next to other people who worked. And that changed with right to buy. Margaret Thatcher swept away a kind of equality there and turned everybody into a rival of somebody who owned their house. Maybe they should own theirs. They didn't yet. What did that make them, a lower class of person? And they didn't replace the housing stock that they were selling off, by the way. So we got to a position where there was fewer and fewer houses available. And so now, in 2018, if you want a council house or some social housing in a big city, you have to fulfil certain categories of need. Being a working class person with a job and two children and a wife who works isn't quite enough. They're not going to give you one of those houses in that situation. You need to match up to some level of need, which is to do with disability, perhaps, or homelessness. So you can understand how the whole culture of social housing has changed as a result of that.
Does home ownership mean anything in a 25-story tower? I mean, the individuality of what we call home ownership in the United States, and are rather proud of historically, means something entirely different.
Well, you know, it's never existed to the same extent in the UK anyway, let me say. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a kind of golden truth, I think, in American domestic life, that to own your property and to see it grow in value and so on, and it to be an asset at the centre of your life, it goes hand in hand with the whole idea of being American, I would say. That's not so true here. It's become truer as the decades have gone on. But when I was growing up, people were very proud to rent their home from the state. The state looked after you. The state had your interests at heart. It maintained to a high degree the quality, the safety of your house. You know, we weren't living in Soviet Russia. It was the United Kingdom in the 1970s I'm talking about. There was just a belief that one shouldn't be caught up in a commercial transaction necessarily with real estate developers in order to live decently. One could live in well-maintained houses constructed by the state. These are working-class people I'm talking about. I know that in America, housing projects have often fell into disarray, just as they have in Europe, but I still hold on to the idea that you could have decent and beautiful social housing maintained by the state for people on lower incomes, but not necessarily only for people who are in desperate need.
Could you have it at 25 stories, though?
I mean, there were only 14 people out of 129 in that block, I should say, who did own their flat. So it was largely a social housing block, you know. But yes, horses for courses. People have different ways of fashioning their lives. It's part of freedom. It's an absolute right. If people want to go off and own their home, then they can take steps to do so. But I believe you should also protect people at the other end who might not be in a position to buy a home, but who nevertheless have the right to live decently.
Rania first came to London from Aswan in 2009 to visit her sister who lived in Cricklewood. Nassim is from Yemen and has spent time with Rania at the Maxilla Children's Centre, a nursery their children attended. She was close to another mother from the Tower, Munira, who lived on the fifth floor. It was a strong Muslim community. Many were from the Middle East, but a sizable number were from Morocco. And some of the local boys referred to Grenfell Tower as the Moroccan Flats.
Andrew, the cast of characters in your piece of residents of Grenfell Tower, some died, some survived, is just so interesting. And they're from all over. They're from Italy, number from Afghanistan, from Yemen, from Egypt, Morocco, you name it, Saudi Arabia, everywhere, Ethiopia. This kind of human village, I hesitate to say ship of fools, but it comes back as a kind of incredibly interesting nest that we would never have expected to find in the center of London. But walk us through it. I want to know how they mythologize, they remember that place and that fire.
I think one of the things it shows us is that we're all strangers in our cities today. You know, those of us who live in big cities, whether it be Boston, Philadelphia, New York, San Francisco, or London, or Birmingham, or Paris, or Madrid, we're living in these cities often in a state of ignorance, or we're badly informed about how whole swathes of our fellow citizens live. One of my jobs in writing this story was to try and give an accurate picture of what that building in a very urban city, in a very modern, rich city. You might say London's become a financial centre over the last 25 years. This was often described as a rich borough and with blocks of immigrant housing there. And I wanted to describe it accurately. And by accurately, I mean give back to people, even people who lived here in London, who think they know their city. They did not know where their cleaners were going home to at night. They did not know where the Uber drivers and the bus drivers that they saw fleetingly every day, where they lived, where their children went to school, how they lived. And that's what I wanted to do in the first opening 10,000 words of this long story about the Grenfell Tower fire, was to give an absolutely accurate picture, if I could, of those Somalians and Syrians and Moroccans and Irish and Italians and people from all over the world who came to live in that tower, not because they were desperate, not because they were forced to live in a slum, but because they felt part of a community in West London, and in this tower in particular. They felt safe and they felt they were part of a social mix. The old man, Mr. Jafari, went every day down Portobello Road to sit in a hardware store. He went there every day, talked to his friends. I spoke to his family. I was able to create a picture of his life. I wanted more than anything, can I tell you, not just to provide a picture, a heartbreaking picture in the end it proves to be, but not just a picture of people enduring deaths, but people, as it were, in the midst of life. And that restores, to some extent, these people. They aren't just faces on a poster, missing persons, names and digits, but they're actually people with lives and children and pasts. That mattered to me.
Yeah, and let me say, you're right. The tragedy is so awful, partly because the village at 23 stories was so intense. The chauffeurs, those student brothers from Syria, the lorry driver, the fishmonger, all sorts of service people, in a certain sense, in the financial capital of the universe. But
Of these people you're mentioning, they had escaped from conditions of real adversity. I mean, the Syrian brothers that you mentioned, they escaped from bombing and civil war in their own country, in Syria, to come to a safe haven. These were asylum seekers very often. And so it adds to one's sense of the heartbreaking nature of this, that they came away from danger only to encounter fatal danger here in the UK. But again, I wanted to tell those stories that these bakers, these drivers, these students, these flower sellers, people who absolutely understood themselves to be part of a modern city which had a place for them. Sometimes reading the coverage now, you would imagine from that media coverage that they were all desperately unhappy, ignored, downtrodden people with no families and nowhere to turn. In fact, they would have given, and indeed did give, the survivors to me, a very reverse idea of their living situation. It was a village, as you say, not perfect, plenty to complain about, plenty to worry about, but their basic conditions were a step up in many cases from what they'd experienced before.
Right. Speak of Rania Ibrahim, an astonishing quick portrait of this woman who felt God everywhere, felt love everywhere, and at the same time felt death was always close.
Rania Ibrahim was a young Egyptian woman who lived on the 23rd floor. Her husband, Hassan, very much part of her life with her two daughters, Hania and Fatia. Mr. Hassan was away in Egypt the night of the fire, tending to a sick brother. And Rania, who was an absolute bundle of life, described as such by all her friends, an amazing, prolific cook, a wonderful mother, an easy spirit, addicted to her social media life, had many, many friends, loved clothes, loved the idea of progressing steadily upwards and onwards into the future with her husband and children. And then she finds herself woken in the middle of the night with smoke and with panic going on in the 23rd floor of Grenfell Tower. She and her children were advised after many phone calls to emergency service to stay put, that the firemen would be coming to get them and taking them down the stairs. Sadly, the firemen never turned up. They never came for them. And I should say that those firefighters very often were battling through horrific conditions, doing their best on every floor to save people. And we know that they saved at least 68. But unfortunately, 72 people died. And that will remain a sadness for everybody. But Rania was exceptional in many ways, not least by virtue of having recorded on Facebook Live those last moments in the tower. And they, of course, went viral on social media, and people were able to listen to her praying and trying to look after her neighbours and her children during those last desperate hours.
أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله محمد رسول الله يا الله لا إله إلا أنت سبحانك يا الله يا رب سترك ورضاك يا الله
We're stuck on the 23rd floor Alarm
مكان في لندن فين
There's too many people stuck upstairs
Coming up, we're summoning the all-time novelist of social justice, Charles Dickens, to imagine a sort of judgment of sin and sainthood around Grenfell Tower. This is Open Source. In the famous Hollywood line, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. Grenfell Tower got its legend all right, though it doesn't quite satisfy Andrew O'Hagan's appetite for a complex truth about Grenfell Tower.
Well, that's the thing, that part of this story is its existence as story. That, like me, and it's understandable, many people arrived at that tower the morning where it was still in flames. We knew it was a desperate situation. It was going to be a mass tragedy. Many people arrived there and already began to listen to only one narrative, the narrative that existed in their head already, about this being a story clearly about the murder, if you like, of poor people by rich people in a capitalist society that was out of control. That's how they saw it. That's how the headline wrote itself. And then they began only to find themselves attracted to material and interviewees and points of view which consolidated and confirmed that predetermined headline. Now, if you're a writer, I go into this as a writer and a novelist. It's my job to try and, to some extent, describe that process, to unfurl it, and to present it to the reader for their consideration. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that that should happen. It happens every day in the news. How often do we watch reports on American television of foreign conflicts and see that the report is being reflected, the event is being reflected, I should say, editorially by reporters, by presenters, even by interviewees, even by the editing process, is being packaged and presented in a way that signs up to a particular point of view. That's a known thing in the media. You don't need to be a college student of media and communications to understand that that happens. We've all lived with this now for many decades. But it acutely came to live at the centre of this story because post-Brexit in the UK, there's a febrile atmosphere about Britain pulling out of Europe, a real divisiveness at the centre of our society surrounding that issue at the moment. Plus, we're perhaps in our eighth or ninth year of austerity here, so divisions between rich and poor, watching what has happened to London property over the last 15 years, that a real divisiveness, for many reasons like those I've mentioned, has come to sit at the centre of our lives in contemporary London. And so what does that equal when it comes to a fire of this magnitude? It means that the media is stoked. They are stoked to find the story they want in this. That's not to say everything they found was, as it were, ideologically constructed, or it's not to say that everything they found was false. It's just to let readers understand that there was an impulse towards the manufacturing of stories in this case from the beginning.
Now, we expect that, in a way, from the land of The Guardian and the Murdoch Press and the Financial Times, for that matter. I mean, but who struck the dominant notes?
You speak of dominant notes quite correctly. There was dominant notes in this story, and they have persisted for a whole year. And the dominant notes were actually most happily promulgated by the liberal press, the press where I would almost on a daily basis find myself most comfortably situated. But nevertheless, if one's going to go for the truth, go for the truth. And the liberal end of the press were convinced, absolutely convinced, that this was one sort of story. Well, the local authority, which is right-leaning conservative council, was responsible for this crime, responsible for these deaths, and that the entire event and the community and local authorities' response to the event should be understood from the perspective of those local authorities, especially the politicians, being responsible. That was how they reported the story for a year. Anything that contradicted that story either wasn't sought or wasn't given airtime. They didn't look at the work logs of the council to see what they'd actually been doing in response to the fire. They didn't look at the history of social housing in the area with any particular regard for how it might have improved, or indeed, the council was perhaps never truly invested, from one perspective, in the idea of social housing, and that that had a part to play, perhaps, in what happened in the end. So here at the pluralistic London Review of Books, we're quite interested in examining the case from as many angles as possible. My personal essay, in the end, fell down on the side of the argument that suggests that the liberal media were not exhaustive, to say the least, in looking to balance this picture up. Not only not exhaustive, but they were actively unwilling to entertain the possibility that a number of factors, a whole concatenation of failures, led to this fire. Most of them, I would suggest, out there in the world of regulatory safety failures and manufacturing failures and corruptions of that sort. They were happy to lay the blame at the door of these individual councillors. And that seemed to me a missed opportunity when it comes to true justice in this case.
It looks like now the crowd's moving toward the main entrance to the office of Kensington and Chelsea Borough. It looks like people are actually trying to get in.
We want justice! We want justice! We want justice!
As you can see, a lot of frustration here.
We're prejudiced by John Lanchester's work in the LRB and that novel, Capital, which is a perfect, almost Dickensian picture of the London of the very rich, transformed by the new international finance money. I mean, isn't that still going to be the story? And then, oh, by the way, where the service people live, there was this kind of insanely flammable cladding to disguise the reality of an old public housing unit.
It's an attractive story, I understand that, and to some extent it has the virtue of having truth around its borders. Yes, there has been a terrible inequality growing up in our society. John Lanchester's a good reference for this. He's a wonderful writer on the subject.
Indeed.
And Capital, his novel, is a masterpiece when it comes to describing exactly these countervailing forces that have pushed us forward in the City of London into a place where inequality really, truly exists. And let me tell you, it's as bad as what you think it could be. But whether we can apply those lessons and rules to this specific block, that's where we begin to look at the detail to speak for itself. Yes, there was terrible cladding on that building. No, it wasn't necessarily put there, according to current evidence, by these right-wing capitalists, as people characterise them. So there is a detail to examine. And we should examine these things. We should want to, if we're interested in truth and justice for the victims. We should also take into account that, yes, that cladding is dangerous, but yes, also, it was on 308 other tower blocks up and down the United Kingdom. So it was judged safe enough by the management organisations or by the councils of other boroughs in the United Kingdom. So, again, that slightly waters down in the mind the zealous view that these particular councils in this particular borough and this relation to this particular block were evil men. It may turn out in the end that they have a big case to answer to, but let's look at the evidence first. And we were talking about mass slaughter charges here. This manslaughter of 72 people, to lay that at the door of individuals or of a failed capitalist system just like that, without actually examining what happened moment by moment, what were the decisions, what were the failings, and let's in the end look at them all, of which some of these big bogeymen might be a part.
But Andrew, those are very different things. Individual guilt and allegedly the failure of a international capitalist system. It seems to me the social history is going to prevail in the way people remember this, and they're going to remember the John Lanchester's picture of the sort of ego architecture of the pickle and the shard, the cheese cutter, this kind of architecture, and the tremendous growth of real estate as private investment. Innumerable thousands of properties in and around London, not as baubles exactly, but as rich men's investments.
There's no arguing with the fact that London has turned into this property playground. The super prime value of properties in London has gone through the roof. There are many, many oligarchs, you know, entering into London property as a way of investing. That to me is undeniable. And it will be linked, as you say, in the public mind for a long time with that burning hulk of a tower. The image is just too attractive that on the one hand you have these mansions worth £35 million, you know, $50 or $55 million, that are sitting empty. Some of the greatest, most expensive real estate in the world has been bought up by oligarchs and is sitting empty with their 35 bedrooms, whilst on the other side, only 5-10 minutes away, the other side of the road, there's this social housing block of an international village of immigrants that has got cheap cladding on there and burns within a couple of hours with the loss of 72 lives. Those two images will be yoked together in the public mind for a long time. But I would also just add that the job of writers and of any broadcaster with an open mind is to slow down the power of those images and actually encourage readers to look at it, to listen to the detail and say, yes, all those things are true, and yet there are other truths concealed within this story too.
Andrew O'Hagan, speak of the journalistic Diogenes looking through the ashes here and the witnesses for an honest account or a good account. Where did you find it? And I'd love to introduce this fellow, Joe Delaney, the tenants' advocate.
My association with the issue is that I'm one of the people who's been evacuated because of this disaster. But as well as that, I mean, even if my particular block hadn't have been evacuated, I know lots of people in the tower who are now dead because of hubris and greed. The official response has been absolutely appalling and remains so to this day.
In Joe Delaney and elsewhere, where did you find voices that clarified it for you?
Well, I found so many instructive voices in the writing of this piece. I mean, this is really a patchwork quilt, if you like, of voices, points of view, memories, descriptions of family life and of past life, and of, in some cases, future hopes, all of them sewn together from the voices of hundreds of people who were either in the town or in the community or the community at large, who had an interest in the affairs of the council or the historical experience people had had there of racism and of activism. Activism was a big part of what we looked at. For me, listening to those voices, voices like Joe Delaney's, a very sensitive guy with absolute commitment. He simply believed that the council in that part of London had serially undermined or underserved the people under its care. And that's a very strong point of view. Many people share it, and I was glad to hear it. My thoughts were probably less aligned with his than he would have hoped or he would have expected even, but that's freedom of expression. That's how it works.
Nobody instructs us even today about London more than Charles Dickens's novels, and particularly Bleak House, but Our Mutual Friend, so many others. What would Dickens have made of this?
Well, it's a fascinating question that, I mean, what would Dickens have thought of it? Because we know some of Dickens's thoughts on it already. He wrote an article about that particular area of London in the 1860s. It was often described, that area, as a quagmire of social diseases. And one writer described it as the Avernus, the eagle-eyed Avernus, was that mythological place in Italy where birds dropped from the sky as they passed over a toxic lake. That's Avernus. And that's how that part of London as it was in the 19th century, was described as a place of such delinquency, of overcrowding, of poverty and disease that one could barely enter it. Charles Dickens caught the very spirit of that in an essay for Household Words, his magazine at the time. But as you rightly indicate, it comes up again and again, that picture of London, of desperation, in many of his novels. You mentioned Bleak House. We have Joe the crossing sweeper, yes, in that novel, a boy so poor that he can barely stand up, so lacking in shelter that he's damp all the way through to the marrow of his bones. Poverty and desperation, and by the way, if you're talking about Dickens, a call for social justice, for real social justice, has been a cornerstone of that great writer's writing since the beginning. And we enjoy it still for those reasons. What he would have made of this, I'm sure, would have been that we live in unbelievably complex times where, against an international backdrop of money and excess and of super prime valuations and inequalities, that we can have the existence of refurbishment programmes such as the one that was done to Grenfell Tower, where cheap materials come into the picture and were put onto that building, perhaps in a way that saved a few hundred thousand pounds, in a city where some oligarchs spend that on a month's gardening, you know. So, of course, he would have recognised those ironies. He would have plumed on those ironies, being the great social justice novelist that he was. But I also believe that he would have looked inside the hearts of the men and women in attendance and tried to see the truth. He was not a great setter up of straw men. He didn't set people up just to knock them down. He looked into the heart of even the guilty, of even the accused. After all, is it not part of the Dickensian social justice programme and the blues to understand what the accused might be facing, what they might have done? And false accusation is often a thing that we ought to look at too in these situations. And I believe that Dickens would have been attentive to that. That was his pattern, to look at everything.
If you were looking for a Scrooge, a modern finance villain, where would he have landed, you suppose? And would he have found Joe the sweeper?
Oh, that's easy. Oh, no, no. He would have found that person. If he's looking for a villain, if he's looking for a Scrooge-like person in all of this, he might have done well to look inside Theresa May's political cabinet, where central government here behaved cynically and opportunistically, according to my findings and my sources, my sources being very close to the present Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, who was Communities Minister at the time of the fire, and Theresa May, the Prime Minister, who were more worried for their own political skin during this response to the terrible fire at Grenfell Tower than they were to helping the victims. Now, if Dickens was around, let me just sign him up for the job, he would see inside their opportunistic hearts. He would see inside their fear for their jobs and reputations very quickly, whilst trying to describe the overall picture of other failures and other needs. So it's an open and shut case for me. Dickens would have been down to number 10 Downing Street and had his magnifying glass out.
Would you have found a saintly victim, the Joe, the sweeper? I think maybe your woman from Egypt, Rania, would have served Dickens very well.
You're absolutely right. I mean, he would have spotted a hardworking, idealistic mother of two going up and down the elevator of that block with food for her neighbours and her friends, a woman of devout religious feeling, a woman of great courage, actually, as she showed in the last moments there. He would have found a character in her, and may she long be an indwelling character and symbol of courage and of desperation too, and of all our follies, all of us, in relation to this terrible event. Because she lost her life along with her two daughters. And it will be one of my remaining sadnesses for decades, if I've got decades, to look back on this case and to look back on my attempt to try and tell the truth of it. I will always have the image of that mother of two, a young woman who felt she had all of life in front of her and snuffed out because of a negligence that we all must bear and that we all must investigate right to the end so that true justice can be established and can be done.
Andrew O'Hagan, thank you so much for a year of extraordinary work and for telling us all about it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Andrew O'Hagan's piece, The Tower, was a whole issue of the London Review of Books in June. There are additional videos and features on the LRB site and a spoken version of Andrew's entire story, narrated by Simon Vance and produced by Autumn, an all-purpose audio app for your iPhone. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Surabi Doné, and the artist Susan Coyne. We had help, too, from Anthony Wilkes at the LRB in London. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is the conscience in our community. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.